back there? Okay. There we go. You guys have enough light? Thank you. All righty. I think they picked the wrong day to come take this. I told them in advance I have to say, so it was going to be in Spanish, but as we say in Spanish, Mr. Bailey. Okay. So, how many of you have seen the movie of this book? What did you think of the movie?
It was much easier to follow.
The movie was easier to follow?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think...
Louder.
I didn't think that the relationship between the mother and Tita was played up enough in the movie. I thought it was...
Did you see the movie before or after you read the book?
After. I thought it was better in the book.
You thought the relationship was better in the book? But
no, which? Not the relationship, just the way it was presented.
It was better in the book.
Yeah.
So which was harder to follow?
Well, the book as a whole, I thought was harder to follow.
Than the movie?
Yeah.
Anybody else share that view? Anybody have the opposite view? Yes. Speak.
I had to see the movie first, actually, for class, and I remember at first I didn't...
Louder, louder.
At first I didn't follow it anywhere close to how easy I thought the movie was to follow.
I must say, I saw the movie first. Then I read the book in English, then I read the book in Spanish, then I saw the movie again. And my own view is that a lot of what I saw in the movie seemed a little disjointed. And only when I saw in the book how those must have actually been flashbacks or just, you know, expanding episodes, did I realize why it was put in there. So I found the movie much better on second viewing after having read the novel. So personally, I found the movie less well integrated. You guys know that the director of the movie is the husband of the woman who wrote the book. Arau is Esquivel's husband. So it's a power couple in Mexico. I saw some nods. So some of you also had my view that the movie was harder than the book. The movie is good, right? You know, that movie made more money than any other foreign language movie in America up until that time. Liz?
I haven't seen the movie, but I just noticed that the people who had spoke, and your view is that whatever they saw or read first was harder to follow. She said she saw the movie first, and that was...
Interesting.
So.
Is that right? Is there anybody for whom that is not true? Is there anybody for whom that is? It's not true for you. Speak, please. Ah, so the book made a nice guide to the movie. Right. Okay. All right. It is confusing, though, which I must say I find really kind of amazing when you realize the exquisite simplicity of the language. I mean, they're not complicated sentences. There aren't very odd adjectives. It's not like Faulkner at all. You know, it's just you can read every sentence clearly, and yet there's something wild about it. Did you guys like the book? Good, good. Me too. I read it again this morning between 11 and 4. But anyway, and I must say I liked it better again. So maybe it's one of those ones that you keep coming back to. I also feel kind of a special relationship to this book because of my grandma Molly. My father's mother, I remember this quite vividly. When I was a little boy, and I mean little, like, three. My folks would park me at my grandmother's house sometimes. Years later, I found out it was because their marriage was precarious and they probably needed to get rid of me so they could work out other things. But what did I know, right? I mean, I was going to grandma's house. And grandma, who was born in Russia, would make me often potatoes and cream, which for Eastern Europeans, that means sour cream, and either baked or boiled potatoes. She made these so-called new potatoes, you know, with a thin skin. She would boil them. And grandma would set out this enormous bowl of sour cream and sit down opposite an enamel table. I can picture it vividly to this day, a metal tabletop, you know, covered with some enamel so that, you know, nothing got through it. I mean, you could chip it with a screwdriver, but that was all you could do to it. And grandma would sit opposite me, the two of us, it was folded up, so it was just a two-person table. And she'd sit there, and I'd have the bowl, and she would have, in her lap, she'd be wearing an apron, she'd have a washcloth, I mean, what do you call it? Dish towel, thank you. Right, it's not a washcloth, a dish towel. Good. How do you say in English? A dish towel covering her lap. And she'd reach under the dish towel, take out a couple of potatoes, and say, "Es, ethical, es." So I, you know, ethical with es. And then I would finish the couple of potatoes, and there'd still be more sour cream. And she'd say, "So you want another potato?" And I'd say, "Sure." And out would come another potato. And it was like an endless, I never ran out of potatoes. I don't know where grandma got them from. She never had to go back to the stove. It was as if she were giving birth to potatoes. You know, it was like constant. And every time I have read this book or seen this movie, I'm always reminded of my grandmother with this endless supply of potatoes. And it reminds me that there's something going on here. It goes right back to the fairy tale roots that we talked about the first week of class, that you don't have to say, "I love you." All you have to do is give somebody food, and that indicates a relationship. I feel that when I read this. And so when I see the variations on it, well, what if you cry into the food while you're making it, or what if you feel anger while you're making the food, and so on, it sort of resonates for me, as if the fairy tale world were becoming a real world. That, to me, justifies having a book made out of recipes. It's really weird. I mean, do you guys know of any books like this? I know of a couple that are vaguely like this, but none exactly. Anybody know any books that are even vaguely like this? Yes, please.
The Earth Belongs by Peter Mann.
Good. You want to describe it?
It's also in segments of monthly periods, and he bought a house in Belongs and discusses the meals and the recipe. The recipe is rapid, so it reminds me of that.
But that's nonfiction. But, yes?
In a way, it sort of reminded me of Tasman Comics, where you have the scientific fact at the beginning and then it played with it throughout the chapter.
Interesting. I think there's another way in which those two books are alike, which I hadn't thought we'd get to until the end of today, but remember how I was talking about Fry's notion of going through the different archetypes until you get so ironic that it comes out to be a new myth? I think that's sort of what's going on here. You get so off the deep end that you wind up with a whole new myth. Although what that myth might be, something, you know, we probably ought to go through the book more before we talk about it. Yeah, but that's certainly not the recipe aspect of it, as they say. Any of you guys read Babette's Feast? You know, we'll see that movie? No. How about Heartburn? Has anybody read Heartburn?
Oh, really great novel.
You gotta read this novel. It's really cool. It's written by Nora Ephron, who was married to Bob Woodward from Bernstein, Woodward, Deep Throat, all that stuff, and the son of a bitch divorced her. And she got her revenge by writing a novel about the breakup of their relationship. One of the factors in their marriage was that he loved her cooking, particularly her two-line pie. And so she works recipes into the book. And the back of the novel has an index of recipes. You can just turn to the one you like. And at the very end of the novel, she finally is enough at peace with him that she figures, the hell with it, and includes the recipe for key lime pie. It's the last recipe she puts into the book and sort of shows that she doesn't give a damn about the guy anymore. So eating well becomes the best revenge. But I have to say, in terms of fiction, not the Peter Miles book, but in terms of fiction, every one of these books that I have ever encountered where recipes are woven into the novel are by women. And since I cook, I'm not entirely sure why that has to be the case, but it is the case, and it says something, I think, about the role of nurturance, and that brings us back to the fairy tale. So this is a very unusual book. It's also unusual that it fits into some bizarre genre, which, any of you have read this in your Spanish class? Two. It's magical realism, right? That's the name for this kind of South American, it's usually thought of as a South American genre, where things are discussed as if they're realistic. You know, this is what happened, that's what happened, and we really have the Mexican Revolution being reported here. And then, you know, all of a sudden, Gertrudis will become so amorous, or to be more etymologically correct, so ardent, that is to say, her flesh is so burning, that the shower bursts into flames. You know, the planks just catch. And it's reported exactly the same way as saying Chencha got raped by the rebels. You know, just that's just what happened. Some people, North Americans, call this magical realism and see it as a variety of fantasy. But some of the most famous practitioners of this kind of writing, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, being the central name that everybody always talks about, whose book 100 Years of Solitude is the one book that everybody in the world agrees is magical realism, and he's a Nobel Prize winner for that and other works. He says that it's not fantasy at all, that if you had grown up as he had in Colombia, why, you would just see that this is how things really happen. This is just how they look to people. So it brings us back to the question of viewpoint, which is always central in our view of the fantastic. Magical realism, is it a variety of the fantastic or not? What I'd like to do is talk about the genre and try to make clear some of the things in the book that maybe are not so obvious. Was it a hard book to read or easy? I mean, you said something about being difficulty following, but maybe I've read it too many times now, but it seemed to me it was pretty clear. It seems clear. So let's see then if we can assume it's clear. Let's see if we can go a little more deeply and then come up with what might be an ultimate meaning for the book. The title, I think, is explained on 151. Como agua para chocolate turns out to be a Mexican proverb that is more or less explained for you about five lines into the first full paragraph on that page. Tita was literally like water or chocolate. She was on the verge of boiling over. Apparently, when you make chocolate out of cocoa powder, what you need to do is get water that's just beginning to show bubbles. If you let it be too bubbly, then the chocolate is terrible. If it's only tepid, it doesn't actually make the right paste. So water for chocolate is just on the verge of being boiling over, which suggests that the book is about passion, somehow or other. It also suggests, thinking of the title, it's about food. Water, chocolate, stuff that tastes good, stuff that's necessary for life. The opening passage is one of birth, with that extraordinary tearing going on, where tears just come and come and come. That infant supplies enough tears to fill a 10-pound sack of salt that flavors the life of everybody around her thereafter. It's very much a book about food and what food may come to mean. I like this book, and I like the way the book reads. But I have to tell you that it's the only translation we have, because the translation is copyright, and the translation rights have only been sold once. But it's not the greatest translation. Not that it's a bad translation, but it doesn't do full justice to the book. So I want to give you some sense of what might be missing. For example, there are puns in the book, as we have it, that don't exist in the original. For example, on 216, it says in the last paragraph, "It was hopeless to try to forget Esperanza." Esperanza is the Spanish word for hope. So it sounds like there's a pun there. It was hopeless to try to forget Esperanza. But in fact, in the Spanish, it says, fue inútil tratar de olvidarse de Esperanza. It was useless to try to forget Esperanza. There's no pun in Spanish. It's not there at all. On the other hand, there are some puns that belong in the book that are missed here. For instance, on 159, it looks like there's a typo. It says, "Most Holy Virgin, who's up in heaven, gather up the soul of my mistress Elena, and let her stop wandering among the shades of purgatory." It turns out that the Spanish also says purgatorio. Purgatorio is the Spanish word for purgatory. Holga is the Spanish word for flee. And if you remember, when Chencha comes back with her husband, she's told she can have the attic room, but first they've got to get rid of all the bedbugs that are up there. So she's talking about a purgatorio. She's talking about a place of long suffering because of the little bugs. That pun is in the Spanish. And I think if you were only reading the English, you might just, you know, think it's a typo. I don't know exactly what the translators should have done there. They could have called it flimbo instead of limbo or something. I don't know. But anyway, there are things going on that are missing, as well as things that seem to be going on there that are not. So let me show you some of this in detail. And I've put together a way that even the non-Spanish speakers will be able to follow it. Laura Esquivel, as far as I can tell, was born in 1951, but I found conflicting sources and I have not been able to reach her herself, so she's more or less 48 years old. Okay. This is what we have. Okay. This is the Spanish original. This is a literal translation. Okay. "Like water for chocolate, como agua para chocolate," and the meaning, of course, we've just talked about. I don't think you would get in the English the idea that that means on the verge of boiling over. That's something you miss if you're thinking in English. "A novel in monthly installments with recipes, romances, and home remedies. Novela de entregas mensuales." Okay? Please notice, mensuales, even if you don't know Spanish, if you know any romance language, right, or the word menstruation, you realize that there's a pun in the Spanish. Right? Mensuales means monthlies. The way we might refer to some magazines as being monthlies, but monthlies is also a slang word for a woman's period. So it's a novel with monthlies as installments, with recipes. Amores doesn't mean romances, it means loves. And remedios caseros, right, which doesn't mean home remedies, it means homely remedies, right, the kind of thing you find in your own house. That's an adjective from the word for house. The epigraph: "To the table or to the bed, you must come when you are bid." Not bad, but the Spanish is "A la mesa y a la cama, una sola vez, sorry, vez, se llama," which literally means "to the table and to the bed, one time only is one called." It seems to me that that's really quite different, and it really makes a difference in how you look at what this novel is about. If what you think this means is that opportunity knocks only once, right, then the fact that Tita and Pedro get together again at the end of the novel, after not being allowed to marry each other near the beginning of the novel, sounds like it undercuts the epigraph. But if you think it means there is one call and that's it, right, there's this one true love in your life, period, then it supports the plot. So it seems to me that if we understand the plot in relation to what the Spanish really says, it really means when it happens, you're bound forever. Now that's a kind of a mystic notion. I don't know. Maybe it's because I was finishing up rereading the novel at 4 a.m, but I was really getting kind of mushy there at the end. Did you guys find that, or is it just me being a middle-aged sophisticated cat? It's pretty amazing, yeah. All that light and, you know, they're dying each other. It's like Romeo and Juliet, except this time she ate candles. Okay, it begins. Chapter 1, January, Christmas rolls. Capítulo 1, Enero, Tortas de Navidad. Tortas does not only mean cakes. Right? It also means a font or a font in printing. Okay? just the way we would say, you know, I have Times New Roman is the font I use. A torta is a font. So we're being told that they are using the font of birth, because Navidad means Christmas, but it also means nativity. So it's anybody's birth, in a way. And so then the question is, whose birth is being referred to, especially since the Christmas rolls are being prepared after Christmas. We're getting the recipe for these in January. So maybe the important birth is Tita's birth, somebody's birth. Ingredients include a can of sardines. Well, lata doesn't actually mean can, it means tin, and it's the word for the metal itself. I think there's some continuing conflict back and forth between things that are edible and things that are not. And that comes out most prominently when we have the recipe for matches that the North American, the gringo gives. All the other recipes are for food that the Mexican gives, Tita. But the one recipe we get for matches comes from a man and an Anglo. And then we see somehow that Tita has managed to combine these different kinds of recipes by eating the candles in that conflagration that happens on the very last pages of the book when she goes into the dark room that is no longer dark with Pedro. In fact, I would suggest to you that one of the great things about this novel is that it works with an enormous set of oppositions. Mexican versus Anglo. Male versus female. Love versus passion, I should say, versus constraint. Notice, for example, Carino's manual of etiquette comes up repeatedly in the book. Why? There are just rules for how you have to behave. Why does Tita have to stay with her mother? Because the rule in our family is, and so on. There's constraint versus freedom. There's politics versus domestic life. All of these oppositions are worked on, and ultimately, at the end of the book, they're all integrated. It's a kind of bittersweet integration. But I think that's part of what we get here, that it's not just a can of sardines, it's a tin of sardines. And then, by the way, the particular kind of biscuit, calera, is a rectangular biscuit. It's not a roll at all, which has a different meaning in Spanish. Not that I find that a particularly significant one, but I'm just trying to be thorough. So I think you can see that the Spanish, in the Spanish, if you were to be reading it carefully, it doesn't undercut anything that you see in the English, but I think you would much more quickly get more deeply into what the book is doing thematically by following the Spanish. Does that sound plausible? How about for your non-Spanish speakers? Is that making sense? Okay. Now, here's where we're still in the beginning. Preparation. The Spanish is manera de hacerse. Let me use my Castilian Spanish. I'm sorry, just not used to an American accent. Manera de hacerse. Okay. Now, hacerse, manera de hacerse does mean method of preparation. But hacerse also means to become or to transform oneself. All right, so if you talk about a caterpillar becoming a butterfly, you can use the verb hacerse to talk about that transformation. So there's something about transformation that's buried in the Spanish, but not in the English. Take care to chop the onion fine. La cebolla tiene que estar finamente picada. The onion must be finely chopped. Okay. Now, notice the difference. This is a direct, you know, order. Take care. This is reflexive. The onion must be finely chopped. The onion is being given primacy. To keep from crying when you chop it, which is so annoying, I suggest you place a little bit on your head. I suggest you, plural, put a little piece of onion on the crown of your head. That's what Moriera means, the crown of your head, with the aim of avoiding the annoying tearing that one produces when one is cutting it. So it's a different idea. Those of you who read Spanish can check my translation if you like. It's a different thing going on here. The trouble with crying over an onion is that once the chopping gets you started and the tears begin to well up, the next thing you know, you just can't stop. The bad part of crying when one chops, pica. Yes, please.
Can you go over just a little bit?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sure. This may be tough. The bad part, can you see? The bad part of crime when one chops, pica, onion, is not the simple fact of crime, but rather sometimes one begins, so to speak, piercing, pica, oneself. And already one cannot stop. Now, I think by the repetition of the verb picar, to refer to what one does to oneself in the process of crime and what one does to the onion, we see a connection between tita and the onions. And we know that we're seeing from the very first pages a connection between tita and her tears. But if you think of what onions are symbolically, even if you don't bother to go to the Thelot's Dictionary of Symbols, I mean, if you think of onions, right, where you just get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, that they are somehow a matter of truth, but a truth which is ultimately ineffable, right? We see her as being this multi-layered creature that has some essential something, powerful something, a desirable something. I mean, onions are in pretty much all these recipes, well, not for the matches, right? A desirable something, which when you get there cannot exist in this world. And that's, I think, what Tita is. She symbolized that. It also happens, by the way, if you do look it up, that onions are a symbol for immortality. Lots of round things are symbols for life of some sort, but onions, because of their layeredness, are traditionally symbols for immortality. So we see her as piercing herself. Now, I'd like to suggest to you that there are religious allusions in this novel, not very heavy-handed and not all that often, but if you think of this as someone who is spiritual, and certainly the spirit world is alive and well in this book, then these piercings may have some other meanings as well, especially if the onion goes on the crown of the head. There are some other particular references. There's 1 to 2 Kings, chapter 1, about Gertrudis comes in. Remember, she comes back as a general, and we're told that she's a leader of 50 men. If you take a look at the second book of Kings, chapter 1, I think verses 8 or 9 through 13 or 14, you'll see Elijah has just refused the king Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus sends a leader of 50 men to go bring Elijah down from the mountain. Elijah says, "Now I'm doing what God says. I'm not coming down." And God blasts and kills all the leader of 50 men and the 50 men. Ahasuerus sends another leader of 50 men, and again Elijah blasts them all. Ahasuerus sends a third leader of 50 men, and this guy says, "Listen, we know that you're God's representative. Would you mind coming and talk to us about that?" And Elijah says, "Oh, sure, as long as you understand, yeah, fine. Yep, my God is really functioning here," and comes down, and everything is just dandy. I think that's part of what's going on with Gertrudis. Gertrudis, the name, by the way, means a trusted maiden. She's clearly not a maiden, since she can only get the fire out of herself by living in a brothel for a year. But in some spiritual sense, she is a maiden, I think, because she is really psychologically innocent. She always has a kind of purity of vision about her. And that's why it is that she was able to escape from Mama Lena. So that reference to Gertrudis as a leader of 50 men is yet another one of the references to the Bible. Another place, you remember that Tita only gets named in the middle of the book? Her name, Tita, means little ant. And it's quite reasonable that the writer of the novel, who speaks in the first person on page 1, and then doesn't speak in the first person again until the very last page of the novel, where she surprises us by saying, "Esperanza, who was my mother, and is now dead, but my father still lives in an apartment, and my brother is coming, my father Alex is going to come over to see me and stuff." She, of course, refers to this person as Tita, which means little aunt. But notice in the whole novel, everybody's calling her Tita. And you would think, if you didn't know Spanish, that that was her name. But in fact, her name is Josephita, which is a female diminutive of Joseph. So she is the member of the Holy Family, La Sagrada Familia, that manages to give birth without actually participating in the transfer of genetic material. Joseph is Jesus' father. without actually having donated sperm. And Tita is the mother of Esperanza without actually having donated an egg. This is the story being retold from a female viewpoint. So I'm suggesting already, if you're reading it in Spanish, you can see some biblical allusions, not to say that it's a biblical story, but one that's concerned with spirituality and coming out of the Mexican Catholic experience, these allusions work. I don't know whether that's ever happened to you, that you just keep crying and crying, but I have to confess it's happened to me many times. Mama used to say it was because I was especially sensitive to onions, like my great aunt Tita. I don't know if to you has happened these things, but to me, this is the simple truth, certainly. The Spanish speakers can check for the translation. This is the simple truth. An infinity of times, which I think is a lot different from many times, if you want to see this as suggesting a mythic dimension to the novel. Mama used to say that it was because I am as sensitive to onion as Tita, my great aunt. What I'm hoping is going on here is that looking at this Spanish, we're seeing that it's really in the English, but as you said, it's not as clear in the English. And we can see what was really being pushed here. Now, here's another recipe, another piece of recipe on page 25 in the book. Place 5 egg yolks, 4 whole eggs, and the sugar in a large bowl. Okay? En una cacerola se ponen 5 yemas de huevo, 4 huevos enteros y el azúcar. Please take a look at what these words actually mean. Large bowl is how cacerola was translated. But actually, it means one vessel for mixing, cooking, and serving. That's the definition of a casserole. And the English could have said a casserole, right, rather than a large bowl. One puts 5 yemas. Please notice that there are 5 women in Mama Elena's household. 5 eggs, 5 women. Yemas, which isn't, they are indeed the yolks, but also the word yema is the bud of a plant and the tip of a finger. So it's all of these beginning things in the Spanish. 4 whole eggs and sugar. Okay? And then the question of what the eggs mean themselves. Huevos, in Spanish, is slang for testicle. It's true in lots of European languages. Not true in English, but that's the common thing to say, is que tiene huevos, boy, has he got balls. But literally, it's boy, does he have eggs. So later on, let's see. We'll get to the point where they say that the eggs reminded me of the white testicles we had to take out of the capon. That's not accidental if you're speaking Spanish. The eggs should be reminded of that. Okay. Adding the remaining eggs 2 at a time. Oh, yes. Beat until the mixture thickens and then add 2 more eggs. Repeat adding the remaining eggs 2. Am I blocking it again? No. 2 at a time. Until the eggs have been added. Okay. Now, what do we have going on in the Spanish? One beats until the mass thickens and one adds 2 eggs, 2 whole eggs more. One continues beating and then continues and until it becomes hardened, thickened, and then one adds the other 2 egg, whole eggs, repeating this step until it ends in incorporating all the eggs, de dos on en dos, 2 by 2, which is missing from the English translation. But 2 by 2, it seems to me, is a reminder that Noah's Ark might be involved here. Also the testicles. And if you wonder why is he taking Noah's Ark, you know, with this 2 by 2 reference here in the beginning, page 185. Let me remind you that at the end, when the fire breaks out, the final conflagration that ultimately covers the entire ranch with ash, we're told that the animals got warning first and were all able to leave. All the ranch animals escaped first. So we have a reverse arc going on. Instead of all of the animals gathering in, all of the animals are exiting. To make the cake for Pedro and Rosaura's wedding, Tita and Nacha had to multiply this recipe by 10 since they were preparing the cake not for 18 people, but for 180. Right? By having that line there, not for 18, but for 180, it should remind us pretty strongly that the number 18 is important. We've already seen that before. It's the number of life. Right? We see it again and again in all Middle Eastern religions, including Judaism and Christianity. And then it goes on. Therefore, they needed 170 eggs, which meant they had to arrange to have that number of good eggs on the same day. The result gave 170 eggs, not meant that they had to have. The result gave it, as if the language produced the result. And that signified that they had to take measures to have reunited this quantity of eggs, of excellent quality, in a single day. It's as if all of this is an ingathering, not a cumulative serial gathering. A different notion here. It's one we can come to understand as we see how the Spanish works, but as we see how the story progresses, but I think it's clear right off the bat in Spanish. And finally, continuing that, Tita beat the mixture while Nacha broke the eggs and added them to it. A fit of trembling shook Tita's body, and she broke out in goosebumps when each new egg was broken. The Spanish for goosebumps is piel de gallina. Hen's flesh. We in English say goosebumps, or goose, hen skin, I guess. In Spanish, they say hen skin. Gallina is hen. So there is a connection being made between Tita, who is feeling like the chicken, and the chicken eggs that she's working with, right? And so on down the line. And here we get to the castration. The egg whites reminded her of the testicles of the chickens that they had castrated the month before. She associated the eggs with the testicles of chickens that had been gelded the month before. Roosters are castrated, then fattened up, that are castrated and fattened up are called capons. Los capones, the capons, son gallos castrados que se ponen a engorda. Capons are castrated roosters set to fatten. The family had decided to serve capons at Pedro and Rosaura's wedding because they would impress everyone with the quality of the dinner as much as the amount of work and so on. This delicate dish was chosen for the prestigious at the best tables. Preparation entailed and brought the extraordinary flavor of the capons. See the continual repetition of the word capon in the literal translation in the Spanish, both the verb and the noun. That gets a little submerged in the English. I think what we're getting there is that the person without sexuality compensates for this by the excellence of nourishment. And that's what we get with Tita. Tita is by far the best cook and the one who doesn't have any children. In fact, when we think she's going to have a child, it turns out simply to be an irregular menstruality. So, The Spanish gives us an insight into what is also available in the English, but I think it's not perhaps quite as clear in the English. Does this make sense? Does this sound right? If you would indulge me, turn to the middle of the book, 124. I'd like to look at a 2.5-page section. This is virtually the center of the book. The book ends on page 246. This starts on 124. There's a section that begins, "She heard John's footsteps coming up the stairs." And it ends, although I don't think it strikes one in normal reading as being separable, it ends in the middle of the next page when it says, "Later the three of them, Tita, Chencha, and John, dried the bedroom, the stairs, and the bottom floor." And so it goes from stairs to stairs. I think that this section is really a paradigm for the way the whole book functions. And since it happens to be at the center, and since something important is going on here, if we slow down and go over this passage with some care, I think we'll see a lot of what's in the book as a whole. She heard John's footsteps coming up the stairs. Now, The Spanish for this, it's worth noticing, is not footsteps. The Spanish for this is, for those of you who read Spanish, escucho los pasos de John subiendo las escaleras. Right? Escucho los pasos. I heard the steps of John going up the staircase. I think that's not insignificant because down below, three lines from the bottom of page 124, it says, and they cried, remembering the steps of the recipe. And in fact, in the Spanish, although etapa, you know, the next segment of a race could have been used for that in Spanish, the word paso is used there again in Spanish. So Esquivel has explicitly given us the same word twice. And I think there's a connection between the steps of the recipe and the steps of John on the stairs. In fact, if you take a look at this passage overall, the beginning of it is someone going up a set of stairs, and the end of it is someone coming down a set of stairs. And stairs clearly then take the same function as, say, a threshold in a room. It's the connecting, it's the liminal space, it's the passage between one realm and another. Down and up, up and down. And we know in this book that that's really crucial because John has just rescued her from being 20 feet up the ladder. It's the one thing that Mama Elena was afraid to do, right? Go up the ladder, to bring her down from that dovecote. So the going up and going down represents a crossing of boundaries, the bringing together of realms that may appear to be impossible to join. This passage, then, is a going up and a coming down, getting out of the world and back into the world. And the steps that John has are just like the steps of a recipe. She was eagerly awaiting his customary visit. John's words were her only link with the world. Tortas, font. The words were the link. If only she could talk, tell him how much his presence and his conversation meant to her. If only she could go down to Alex and kiss him like the son she didn't have, play with him until they were tired. If only she could remember how to cook so much as a couple of eggs. Okay? A couple of eggs. Right? Huevos. Right? She wants to get her reproductive functioning going again. Enjoy any kind of food. If only she could return to life. Now, in fact, what's going to happen at the end of this two and a half page section is that she will come down the stairs. It's as if she's returning to life. And she says that. Therefore, her wish at this moment, if only she could return to life, is, I think, a manifestation of what we call the omnipotence of thought. This book is indeed built on many of the same psychological structures as fairy tales. And the centrality of the eggs here is just like the centrality, say, of the snake and the white snake in the Grimm fairy tales, or the sun or the golden ball in the Frog Prince. It's that same kind of natural archetypal symbol. She wants to return to life. She's able to return to life. There are a number of places in the book where her omnipotence of thought is demonstrated. Speaking of other books that this is like, who mentioned Calvino? Who was that? Yes, thanks. At this moment, it seems to me it's a lot like Women on the Edge of Time. Just the way Consuelo is so eager to have a child again. She wants something, and she winds up with Dawn. So we wind up with Esperanza, Cortita. It's this yearning to have somebody to be a parent for. She noticed a smell that struck her, a smell that was foreign to this house. John opened the door and stood there with a tray in his hands and a bowl of oxtail soup. By the way, that's a mistranslation again. It actually is cattle tail soup. And it turns out later on it's referred to as cattle tail soup. So the translator translates the same term two different ways. I don't know why. It's sopa de res, not sopa de bue. She couldn't believe it, and behind John in came Chencha, covered in tears. Now, we've been told in the very first pages that in this book, tears are indistinguishably both happy and sad. Just, there it is. So there, and it's salt your food, so it's the salt of the earth. The embrace they exchanged was brief because they did not want the soup to get cold. I find that amazing, because Chencha has brought this from I don't know how many miles away. Right? I mean, the soup has got to be cold, but there's this idea that you eat it right away so it won't get more room temperature than it is now? I don't know. It's the ritual of the consumption of the sewer. With the first sip, Nacha appeared at her side. There's magical realism. We're not being told she hallucinated Nacha. Nacha appeared at her side. And her dead, it's her fairy godmother. Right? There she is. She's really there. Stroking her hair as she ate, as she had done when she was little and was sick, kissing her forehead over and over. There were all the times with Nacha, the childhood games in the kitchen, the trips to the market, the still warm tortillas, the colored apricot pits, the Christmas rolls, the smells of boiled milk, bread with cream, chocolate atole, cumin, garlic, onion. As always throughout her life, with a whiff of onion, the tears began. Central image for Tita. Immortality, inscrutability, essentiality that is not of this world. She cried as she had not cried since the day she was born. It's the first page of the book. And it's really important that that's the case because this is the center of the book. She's going to be reborn in this very passage. And then at the equal distance at the end, she's going to be going all the way back now to heaven from which she had originally been born. How good it was to have a long talk with Nacha. Just like old times, when Nacha was still alive and they had so often made oxtail soup together. Chencha and Tita, which at this point I think we have to recognize means auntie, laughed, reliving those moments, and they cried, remembering the steps of the recipe. Each step of each recipe is a way towards something. Each one is a completion or is a passage toward something that makes us, because food is to be ingested. Hence the eating of the candles at the end. At last, Tita had been able to remember a recipe once she had remembered the first step, chopping the onion, to say. It's a very important symbol. The onion and the garlic are chopped very fine and placed in a little oil to fry. As soon as they become transparent, the potatoes, beans, and chopped tomatoes are stirred in until the flavors meld. Now, that switch from the narrative of what's going on to a continuation of the recipe is absolutely typical of this book, right? You get every chapter has that kind of switch in narration. What I'd like you to pay attention to is that that switch is a switch in verb tense. You could read page 124 as if it were all simple past, right? She heard John's footsteps. It doesn't mean she heard John's footsteps again and again and again. It means she heard John's footsteps once. But when it says the onion and the garlic are chopped very fine, it doesn't mean she chopped the garlic and the onion fine that day. It means forever in this process, onions and garlic are chopped always, finally. This is what's known grammatically as an iterative tense. It just does the thing again and again and again. I've got a friend, Danielle Chatelain, who's written an entire book on and the argument that iterative tenses are what define the structure of narrative worlds. That the particular that gets reported of a narrative world, this happened and that happened, are only, as it were, the corks floating on the ocean. But the ocean is defined by those things that are always there. So if you say something like, he was always glad to see his friends, but today he was afraid to tell them what he had just discovered. That today he was afraid to tell them what he had just discovered is what we usually focus on. But Dani's point is that he had always been glad to tell his friends is what constitutes the narrative world. And I think you can see the nature of the argument that's pushing there. I'm not asking you to accept it as being complete, you know, always the case. But can you see the difference she's drawing between a simple past and an iterative past or an iterative present? Okay. I would like to suggest to you that in this novel, the continual return to an iterative present for the exfoliation of the recipes suggests that the world of this narrative has lots of corks floating on its surface. But what constitutes this narrative world is the constant process of making food. And it's not just the constant process of making food. It's the constant process of making food that bridges two completely different kinds of world. On the one hand, we have the natural world of the ranch. Again and again, we see Tito running around and saying, oh, I don't have the rest of the ingredients for this. I either have to prepare these and preserve them, or, well, these people are coming over too soon. Can I make something really good with what I have around? We have the reality of the physical world. And on the other hand, we have the symbolic reality of the written out recipes. And we know that this is a real issue in the book because we have that wonderful comic passage where Gertrudis wants her cream fritters. And that poor sergeant, who's never cooked before in his life, you know, yes, my general, you know, is trying so hard to follow the written recipe to give her what she wants. So we have the process of making the recipe yet again and again forever as bridging these two worlds, the symbolic intellectual world and the natural physical world. That's, I think, what constitutes this narrative world fully. That's what the ocean is here. John interrupted these memories by bursting into the room, alarmed by the stream that was running down the stairs. I would think that this stream is not only a recollection of Tita's birth with that enormous flood that came out from her crying in the amniotic fluid, but also, as we've seen in book after book, something about time. Because notice the verb tense has changed here. Right, so something is happening. We've been out of time for a moment with the recipes, which are eternal, and then we're back into history. When he realized it was just Tita's tears, John blessed Chencha and her oxtail soup for having accomplished what none of his medicines had been able to do, making Tita weep, which is a good thing. Sorry to have interrupted, he started to leave the room. Tita's voice stopped him. That melodious voice had not spoken a word for 6 months. Exactly halfway around the year, death and rebirth. John, please don't leave. At Tita's side, John watched her go from tears to smiles as she heard all the news and gossip from Chencha. The doctor learned that Mama Elena had forbidden visits to Tita. In the De La Garza family, some things could be excused, but not disobedience, not questioning parental authority. Garza is the Spanish word for heron, and that's the family she comes from. A heron is a very interesting bird symbolically. It's associated with water, so it looks like fertility. It's associated with a stork because it has the same kind of long beak, so it looks like it has something to do with bringing babies. But in fact, it is usually thought of as a bird that fishes. It goes and gets the fish out of the water, dives in, gets the fish out, and consumes it. And since the fish is traditionally a symbol for the soul or the unconscious, and specifically, you know, Jesus, but the heron is associated with birth, but is not in fact birth. And that's the family she comes from, the De La Garza family. In this family, you could do a lot of things, but not disobedience. Remember our reading of Genesis. God says, you know, where are you? Adam says, I'm hiding. All right. How did you dare disobey? How did you know I was disobeying? Because you're hiding. Right? Disobedience is the crucial split from heaven. Mama Elena would never forgive Tita, crazy or not, for blaming her for the death of Roberto. She had forbidden anyone to even mention Tita's name, just as she'd done with Gertrudis. Of course, Nicholas had returned recently with news of Gertrudis. He had actually found her working in a brothel. It's an interesting way of putting it. Was she like the cook? They're trying to dissociate what she's doing from anything that might actually affect her morality. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about Gertrudis, which is part of what I meant about her being fundamentally innocent. She is like a force of nature. In the movie, I think that's pretty clear with her red hair, and she's the most buxom of the sisters and so on. She just looks like some, you know, cycladic fertility goddess. He had actually found her working in a brothel. He had delivered her clothes to her, and she had given him a letter for Tita. Back again in that symbolic world. Chencha gave it to her, and Tita read it to herself. Dear Tita, you can't know how grateful I am that you sent me my clothes. Fortunately, I was still here to get them. Tomorrow I will be leaving this place, which is not where I belong. I still don't know where that is, but I know that I have to find the right place for myself somewhere. The Gertrudis is leading the sisters, just as Rosaura is holding the sisters back. Right? Rosaura is the conservative one, wanting to take advantage of the weighty traditions Mama Elena tries to impose on the family. Gertrudis is the one who's willing to break out. So Tita occupies this interesting middle position between the progressive and the conservative. And she's always trying to do both. She eventually does manage to bring them both together, but at that moment, she reaches sexual climax, destroys the ranch, and dies. I ended up here in the brothel because I felt an intense fire inside Ariente. The man who picked me up in the field, in effect, saved my life. I hope to meet him again someday. This is a very, very enlightened view of what other people might have looked upon as certainly an ungentlemanly act. He left because I had exhausted his strength, though he hadn't managed to quench the fire inside me. Now, at last, after so many men have been with me, I feel a great relief. Perhaps someday I will return home and explain it to you. I love you, your sister Gertrudis, the trusted maiden, still virginal in a sense, because these men were just saving her life. This was all for her, not for them. And in fact, she does come home. Tita put the letter in the pocket of her dress without a word. The fact that Chencha didn't ask her anything about the contents of the letter was a clear sign that she had already read it from one end to the other. These people know each other intimately. Later, the three of them, Tita, Chencha, and John, okay, the Mexican, her servant, her Anglo lover, three different classes, two different genders, different backgrounds, everything, drive the bedroom, the stairs, and the bottom floor. I think that this passage, which I say is right in the middle, this is the one where she gets reborn. This passage is, in some sense, crucial for the novel as a whole, but it's also typical of the novel as a whole. Lots of things begin in one direction and then unfold in the other direction. We see that with the tears in the beginning, the water in the beginning, and the fire at the end. We see a balancing of symbols in the work as a whole. Very, very delicately and cleverly constructed, I think. Before I go on, does that seem, am I on target here with this as far as you're concerned? Okay. Clearly what I'm building is an argument that as easy as the book is to read, it's worth a lot of detailed attention. It's not accidentally easy. It's in fact spectacularly clearly constructed to make it feel easy. The politics of this book, I think, are important. Politics comes up again and again. I found it quite surprising, maybe because movies have a way of emblazoning their visual images on your mind, I found it really surprising as I was rereading the novel to see that Chencha's rape and Mama Elena, the attack on Mama Elena, those two events, cataclysmic, are described entirely in one paragraph. Because in the movie, you see the rape, I mean, from a long distance, but you see it, and the image of that has stayed in my mind. I saw it when it first came out in the theater, so it must be 4 or 5 years ago now. But in the book, it's one paragraph. And yet the politics is there throughout. So it's not just the different kinds of worlds, but also different kinds of situations. Let's take a look. On 32, we see how the politics affects pretty much everything, even though they tend not to talk about it. Last paragraph. With that, Tita fled from the kitchen into the room where Chencha and Gertrudis were embroidering the sheet for the wedding night. It was a white silk sheet, and they were embroidering a delicate pattern in the center of it. This opening was designed to reveal only the bride's essential parts. By the way, in Spanish, it's the bride's noble parts. I'm not sure either of those is how I would describe what's being exposed there, but anyway, clearly they're different. While allowing marital intimacy, how lucky they had been to obtain French silk at that time of political instability. The revolution made it impossible to travel in safety, which is why if it hadn't been for a Chinaman who dealt in smuggled goods, it would have been impossible to obtain the material, since Mama Elena would never have allowed one of her daughters to risk traveling to the capital, etc. And then we go on for another paragraph and a half about the machinations of this Chinaman and how he manages to end up at the end of the revolution. It says, so he spent, about a third of the way down page 33, the entire revolution until he wound up a millionaire. But the important thing is that thanks to him, Rosaura would be able to enjoy the finest, most exquisite fabric on her wedding night. So this guy is profiting. The Mexican Revolution, I'm no expert on Mexican history, but I tried to figure out when the hell the Mexican Revolution was, and I can't. I mean, everybody seems to agree it started in 1910, and everybody seems to agree it's definitely over by 1935. But exactly when it gets over depends upon whose view of history you're reading. You know, is it with the first election? Is it when the corrupt elected people are thrown out and you get clean government again? Is it with the establishment of the revolutionary, institutionalized revolutionary party, PRI, 35? Where is it? It's somewhere between 1910 and 1920. We know that this is starting when Tita is 15. And we know that the wedding of Esperanza and Alex is when Tita is 39. So we know that 24 years have passed. If we like, we can think of these 24 years then as not coincidentally the time from the beginning of the revolution, 1910, with deposing of Porfirio Ruberosa Diaz, and ending in 1934 with the establishment of the governmental monopoly of the PRI, which, by the way, is the party that's still in power in Mexico. It's been basically a one-party country until quite recently, and still the presidency has never gone to anyone who wasn't a member of the PRI. So that 24-year period, from the outbreak of violence until the peace of this establishment, looks like it's what's going on in this book. That, again, I think cannot be coincidental. Mexican readers must really understand that those are the dates that this book covers. It's really interesting that they need Chinese workers to get French silk in order to make sure that their Mexican customs are properly carried out. And all of that is made difficult by this political instability. The political world is a violent world. But ultimately, this violent world, the political world, turns around and becomes a peaceful world. 1934, maybe. On page 240, almost at the end, at the bottom, we have another one of these wonderful food passages, and this one, again, is intimately tied to the plot. The chiles not only looked good, they were indeed delicious. Never before had Tita done such a marvelous job with them. The platters of chiles proudly wore the colors of the flag. The green of the chiles, the white of the nut sauce, the red of the pomegranates. Now, red, white, and green are not necessarily compatible. I mean, if we talk about things being contrastive, they are three very different colors. Right? But what's going on is that they are now being viewed as the flag. If you go to the website that is Flags of the World, okay, FOTW, it's actually an FOTW site, you'll find that Mexico has had a whole series of flags. And the current flag, which is this flag, is the flag that came into being in 1934. So this is the moment when the PRI takes over that these colors are brought together. These tricolor trays didn't last very long. The chiles disappeared in the blink of an eye. How long ago it seemed that Tita had felt like a chile in nut sauce left sitting on the platter out of etiquette. Right? That sense of imposed constraint on ordinary feelings for not wanting to look greedy. Tita wondered whether the fact that there was not a single chile left on the platters was a sign that good manners had been forgotten, or that the chiles were indeed splendid. Her fellow diners were delighted. What a difference between this wedding and that unfortunate day when Pedro and Roxara got married, when all the guests had been overcome by their rejoicing. which of course it wasn't food poisoning. Now, what I would like to suggest, as I've been trying to, you know, work back and again to this thesis, the book is structured on oppositions, but somehow offers us the promise that these oppositions can be melded together for something beautiful. If you take a look at that detail in the middle of the Mexican flag, you'll see, those of you who have been to Mexico City will certainly recognize this, this detail in the middle is a little parable about the founding of Mexico. This is like a graphic version of the founding myth of the entire nation. Mexico City today occupies an area near Tenochtitlan, which was, and that's the Nahuatl name for it, the ancient Mexican language. Actually, there are 4 million native speakers of Nahuatl still around, so it's pretty cool and ancient, but the pre-Columbian Mexican language. The legend is that an eagle flew and captured a snake and landed on a cactus by a lake. And this conjunction of powers, remember the ancient notion of the plumed serpent that the Mexicans used to represent their spiritual force before Christianity, the serpent with feathers, the plumed serpent. This conjunction of powers led them to know that this was the place to build the city. And by the way, in 1400, according to most demographers' estimates, in 1400, before Columbus, in 1400, what we now call Mexico City, the place where this cactus was the largest city in the world, the entire world. So this valley, which today is one of the most smog-ridden, comes about by this mystical conjunction of opposing forces brought together as a perfect emblem on the heart of this flag. I think that's what she's saying is going on. The politics could be violent, but the politics could get worked out. Once the politics gets worked out, things look different. Viewpoint, in other words, is crucial. An easy way to look at the theme, a theme of this book, I don't think it's the only theme, I think the real theme has to do with the transcending of oppositions in human feeling. But a way to approach that would be to look at what's clearly a thematic statement that Gertrudis utters on page 190. The truth, look, Tina, the simple truth is that the truth does not exist. It all depends on a person's point of view. And then that goes all the way on until about six lines from the bottom of that page, where Gertrudis is making an argument about how, well, this is true if you look at it one way, but it could be true if you look at it another way, and so on. I would like to back away from this book for a minute to take a look at a passage from Pierre Menard, author of the Quixote, by Jorge Luis Borges, a writer who was publishing from the late 30s on. He's the one who wrote Emma Zuntz, which I read to you a piece of before, remember, how Emma Zuntz went to be called Mr. Lowenthal to the about the strike, and then she went and killed him, and then she talked to the police and said, yes, true was her anger, true was her shame, all that was different were the names and a few details. We talked about that in relation to Homclier's The Erasers. That same author, Jorge Luis Borges, wrote Pierre Menard, author of the Quixote. The premise of this story, essay, is that there is some guy named Menard who has decided that, and this predates Gabriel Garcia Marquez doing his writing, and certainly well before Like Water for Chocolate, because Like Water for Chocolate was published after Borges had already died. But he is retrospectively understood to be one of the masters of magical realism. The premise of this story, essay, is that there's a guy named Menard who decides he wants to write the Quixote, the greatest work of Spanish literature. And he wants it to be identical to Cervantes' Quixote. Now, obviously he could just copy it, but that wouldn't be writing in any significant sense. The essay talks about this. Then it said, well, the next idea that occurs to Menard, a Frenchman, The next idea that occurs to Menard is that he could steep himself in the 16th century history of Spain. He could move to La Mancha. He could try to come to feel the landscape. And inspired by his surroundings and his readings, he could spontaneously compose a book which, if he did it right, would automatically be the Quixote. But again, the essay says, Menard decides this is too easy. Instead, what he's going to do is inhabit the modern world in such a way that his understanding of the modern world will produce a book which spontaneously is word for word identical with the Quixote. And this, the essay tells us, Menard has achieved. The essay then goes on to do an analysis of Menard's Quixote as opposed to Cervantes' Quixote, which, of course, you understand are word-for-word identical. So, here's how the essay goes on. And this is just a little passage from it, just as I gave you a passage from Lemon Zunz by the same author. 1939 is the date of this essay. Magical realism, for sure, right? Or maybe not. Because remember, Borges says magical realism is just the way we look at things in Latin America. It is a revelation to compare Menard's Don Quixote with Cervantes. The latter, Cervantes, for example, wrote, part 1, chapter 9, truth, whose mother is history, rival of time, depository of deeds, witness of the past, exemplar and advisor to the present, and the future's counselor. Written in the 17th century, Quixote, the first part of Don Quixote comes out in like 1601, so you'd have to live in 16th century Spain, but it's a 17th century text because it's like right at the cusp, turn of the century. Written in the 17th century, written by the lay genius Cervantes, this enumeration is a mere rhetorical praise of history. Menard, on the other hand, writes, truth, whose mother is history, rival of time, depository of deeds, witness of the past, exemplar and advisor to the present, and the future's counselor. History, the mother of truth. The idea is astounding. Menard, a contemporary of William James, does not define history as an inquiry into reality, but as its origin. Historical truth for him is not what has happened, it is what we judge to have happened. The final phrases, exemplar and advisor to the present, and the future's counselor, are brazenly pragmatic. The contrast in style is also vivid. The archaic style of Menard, quite foreign after all, suffers from a certain affectation, not so that of his forerunner, who handles with ease the current Spanish of his time. There is no exercise of the intellect which is not, in the final analysis, useless. Now, I think what's going on in this passage is a suggestion that Gertrudis' argument that truth really is fundamentally subjective, and that there are many, many truths, is valid. In fact, since we see different truths functioning here according to who blows up and who glows, you know, we see Mama Elena's ghost in the dark room, but it's actually Pedro and Tita making love. What we see here, I think, is that all natural phenomena, in fact, are phenomenological. We discussed this before when we were I was arguing to you that the different literary periods could be understood in terms of the relationship that's fundamentally postulated between nature and humanity. And in the postmodern period, what we get is that nature is a phenomenological construct. It is an intentional, right, as opposed to extensional. It's an intentional act of consciousness. I think that's what we're getting here. And if that makes, does that make sense? Are you following me now? Or, yes. Corey? No. Remind you, phenomenology says that a phenomenon is not just out there, but it's an intentional act of consciousness. We focus in and separate something out, and we construct it as a phenomenon so that we notice it. There is no World War II. What? When is the Mexican Revolution? Right? Is it 1910 to 1934 or 5? Is it 1910 to 1920? We have to construct it, and we make it into a thing. The same thing is true for you guys. I mean, I don't see you as attached to that table. I know you're separate from it, but I could look at you and just see you as growing out of the table. Right? So I construct a phenomenon. We all do that. What postmodernism does is see our whole relationship with nature as phenomenological only, as only a matter of our conscious constructions. Okay? If this magical realism can be viewed as Cortázar and García Márquez and Borges do, that's Julio Cortázar, another great exponent of this kind of writing. If, as these people do, you can view magical realism as just the way reality looks, if you happen to be growing up a Latin American, then what they're saying is nature has these things in it because we really see them in it. That, in fact, magical realism treats all of the world around one as a phenomenological construct, and therefore is fundamentally postmodern. Is that making sense? Yes or no? Okay. So, if that is the case, let's take a look at the end. What should we be making of the world if we have the opportunity, if we have the recipes? Starting down about a quarter of the way from the bottom of page 242. For the first time in their lives, Tita and Pedro could make love freely. This is the moment of release. They went into the dark room. Before entering on the top of 243, Pedro took her in his arms, slowly opened the door, and before his eyes, the dark room was completely transformed. His eyes changed. We're right back to Kafka. Right? The way you look at it makes how it is. All the furniture had disappeared. There was just the brass bed standing royally. Put the onion on the crown of your head on the first page. Standing royally, crown of your head, in the middle of the room. The silk sheets and bedspread were white. This is virginity. This is the first time, morally speaking. Like the floral rug that covered the floor and the 250 candles that lit up the now inappropriately named dark room. Tita was moved at the thought of the work that Pedro had done to prepare the room in this way, and so was Pedro, thinking how clever she had been to arrange it all in secret. Each thinks it's been done by the other. Who did it? They were so filled with pleasure that they didn't notice that in a corner of the room, Nacha lit the last candle. The dead fairy grandmother is there, godmother, raised her finger to her lips as if asking for silence and fading away. How does the narrator know this? How does the narrator, Tita's niece, know that Nacha was there? I think she knows because she has eaten the food prepared with the recipes that she inherited, and that gives her a deeper understanding. Skipping down the page, the doves flee the ranch, and with them fled the other animals. Here we have the reverse arc going on. She remembered the last two lines, then the words that John had once spoken to her, if a strong emotion suddenly lights all the candles we carry inside ourselves, and so on. That's that passage about the igniting of the soul, which happens on 116. But Tita checked her passion. She didn't want to die. She wanted to explore these emotions many more times. This was just the beginning. But Pedro was dead. Surely Pedro had died, I'm in the last paragraph, 244, at the moment of ecstasy when he entered the luminous tunnel. Talk about your Freudian symbols. She regretted not having done the same. Then begins immediately the freezing chill, and out comes the enormous bedspread. How big is it on the top of 245? It covered the whole ranch, all 3 hectares. 3, I think, is a good number because we see that this is a religious thing going on. Think of the altar, the bed, the holy bed, all the candles, and so on. It happens that hectare is 2.471 acres, so it's about 7.5 acres that's being covered here. But that's 8.5 acres. But anyway, 3 hectares. The box of candles that John had given her, and she begins to eat the candles one by one. At the bottom of that paragraph, they left together for the lost Eden. Never again would they be apart. They set on fire the bedspread, which ignited the whole ranch. The dark room was transformed into an erupting volcano. I think sexuality for both of them. On the top of the last page, a layer of ash several yards high covered the entire ranch. What we need to remember is that doesn't kill anything. Because we're told on page 59 that the smell of roses from the parking lot that was made of the place where Gertrudis immolated the shower to this day still smells of rose roses. So there's ash there. There'll be an apartment building there. But the past is sensually still present. When Esperanza, my mother, Hope, the mother of the narrator, not the mother of history, returned from her wedding trip, all she found in the remains of the ranch was this cookbook, which she bequeathed to me when she died, and which tells in each of its recipes this story of a love interred. Only for those who can read the recipes rightly, this narrator. My father, Alex, still lives in one of the apartments, and this is the narrator's birthday. He's coming over. The last sentence. I don't know why my Christmas rolls never turn out like hers, or why my tears flow so freely when I prepare them. Perhaps I'm as sensitive to onions as Tita, my great aunt, who will go on living as long as there is someone who cooks her recipes. What we see here is a fairy tale of human passion going beyond human constraint, of love going beyond society. It's bittersweet because the modern world is not constructed to allow it, but for those who are willing to lose themselves in their sensuality, like food, it becomes possible. Pedro and Tita are gone, but live forever. And I think that's why I get mushy, because it looks like they left me this gift too. I think it's a marvelous, marvelous book. Thanks for staying here. Don't forget, I need you on Thursday. Student evaluations, wrap-up lecture, slideshow, goodies.